To have Dr. Barry Nailbuff and Dr. Ian Ayers, both at Yale. I found them stumbling across a book in the library, big yellow cover with life cycle investing. I read it, and I hope everyone reads it, because it was honestly very eye-opening, and essentially it's definitely not something that you're going to be seeing on TikTok or on social media, that's for sure. So we're happy to have them here, talk investing, talk about everything that they've been doing. And I'm happy to have them on here because there's so many great professors such as Barry and Ian, but they're busy doing research and doing things for people to take advantage of. So for them to take time out of their day to come on a podcast is really special. So happy to have them both here. So let's talk investing. Ian, what you said, you got some exciting news this morning. Talk to us about what you got.
Sure. So we've done an analysis of how to implement this leveraged life cycle strategy that I think we'll talk about more. And it's just giving a range of approaches for different types of investor. Let's say you're the kind of investor who has been investing 80% in stocks, 20% in bonds, or 75% in stock, 25% in bonds. And you wanted to know how to implement versions of this leveraged life cycle. And so there, we've now come up with some analysis that suggests, well, one approach is that you could have the same expected return on your investments, but just use all this new tool to reduce risk. How much would your risk be reduced? And if you use this new kind of a life cycle, you could reduce your risk by about 20%. Or alternatively, you could take this new diversification tool and you say, no, I don't want to have the same expected return. I want to keep my risk constant, and I instead want to safely take on some more equity. Well, then you can, I can tell you that you can increase your expected retirement accumulation by about 16%, keeping your risk constant. And so, or people could mix between these strategies and both have increase their return and reduce their risk somewhat.
Awesome. Barry, you're in this research too, Barry, because you and Ian work together on the book.
Absolutely. So the general idea that people have misunderstood is they focus on diversification across stocks. So they hold an S&P 500 in terms of a large number of stocks, but what they fail to do is diversify their portfolio across time. And in particular, they have way too much exposure to the market when they're old, close to retirement, and not nearly enough exposure to the market in their 20s, 30s, and 40s. And as a result of that, they not only miss the opportunity to have market exposure, but they have uneven market exposure. And that means that if the market has a downturn, as it has recently, and you're close to retirement, you're screwed. There is not much you can do about that. On the other hand, if you have better balance of your portfolio over time, so that you're more evenly invested across your 20s, 30s, 40s, compared to your 50s and 60s, then you don't have to have as much in the market when you're old, and therefore you can have less risk. The reason why that's hard is that people think they don't have enough money to have real exposure to the market. They don't have enough savings in their 20s, 30s, and 40s. And the answer is that you can invest more than you have by using leverage. We do that with houses all the time. People buy houses with 10-to-1 leverage. They used to buy it with 20-to-1 leverage. And what we're suggesting is use 2-to-1 leverage to get more exposure to stocks when you're young.
Andrew, any of that makes sense to you? Because you're in the mortgage space primarily.
It does. So I was going to say, should we use more at 20 is there like a number we should be using at 20 versus 30 versus 40 versus 45? Is there?
Yeah. It's you should start out at 200%, 2-to-1 leverage, and that you should over time ramp down, just like in a traditional life cycle, except from they tend to start at about 90% in stock, 10% in bonds. We suggest you should start 200% in stock and then de-lever and then go down, depending on your risk preferences, de-lever to the point that you might go down to 50 or 60% in stock and 40 or 50% in bonds as you get close to retirement.
Yeah, for most people, they're going to want to be at 200% through their 20s and 30s and probably even their mid-40s. Because you're trying to have a constant dollar exposure to the market. And so therefore, you have to have enough savings so that two times what you're investing, two times your savings is actually the level at which you invest. And so if you'd like to have $100,000 of exposure to the market, well, if your savings are $20,000, then you can get 40 of exposure. When your savings are 30, you can have 60. When you've got 50,000 of savings, you're just at the right point. And then when you have 60,000 of savings, you don't go up to 120, you still keep your investment at 100. And so you keep on delevering until your savings hit 100,000. At that point, you don't need to use leverage anymore.
Mm-hmm. This year has been weird because bond prices have gone down a lot because of rising interest rate environment. So being that older investors, let's just say you're at some investment firm, we won't name any names. And they're like, hey, Andrew, you're approaching retirement, let's take a 50% stock, 50% bond portfolio. Knowing interest rates are going to rise up, what would you say to people that are implementing those strategies based on our current environment?
Well, our bond strategies are, relatively speaking, short-term bonds. And so, therefore, they're less affected by the interest rate changes. So we're thinking of that as a safe security, not that they are perfectly safe. And, of course, you could also invest in TIPS if, again, you want to worry about issues of inflation.
Awesome. Ian, you got anything to add on that?
No, it's not a riskless asset as your question kind of emphasizes. And so in part, you want to be have some diversification with regard to all asset classes. And we're deeply in favor of people being diversified across assets. And we're just trying to add to that the only other form of diversification that is possible, which is diversification across time.
Right.
So we talked about you can get basically 2x, right? Is real estate, you get 10 or 20x because you can put a little bit of money down. Mm-hmm. And you get a lot more exposure. Is that a better investment or
no?
And it's you're saying no, but you're shaking your head. Yes.
Yeah. Well, it's because you're raising a great point. Is what the why I'm shaking my head. But it's we say in our book two cheers for real estate investment. It is a way. It's really the only way that most people get a kind of time diversification with regard to real estate assets, which you should also have part in your portfolio in one way or another. But it's not that people sacrifice diversification across assets. It's a very lumpy asset. And that and so it's better to in most cases to continue to have better diversification. I mean, you might want to buy real estate because you'd like to have a place to live. So, but as a pure investment, it's sacrificing too much asset diversification, I think, especially once you take into account that you can get this cheaper approach and you can borrow money to buy stock more cheaply than you can borrow money to buy real estate. And there are good reasons for that. It's a less leveraged purchase and it is callable. And that makes lenders be willing to lend to you at a more competitive rate.
To push back a little on Ian, I'd say you don't have to in life say or, it can be and. And so it's okay to own a house and to have stock portfolio. And the type of stocks we're thinking about are retirement savings. So just like you shouldn't have all your eggs in real estate, I'm also happy for you not to have all your eggs in equity. Therefore, you can do some of each. And since you have to live somewhere, whether or not you rent or own is a choice that you'll make in terms of there are high transaction costs with buying and selling houses. So it depends on, are you going to be in one place for a long time? But note that with a house, if you buy a $500,000 house or apartment, you have $500,000 of exposure to the market over a very long period of time. And that constant exposure is something we're equivalently trying to achieve with equities.
Yeah, and with that, how come you feel like a lot of people aren't using the strategy?
Yeah, I think they're scared. They've been taught from high school that the Great Depression was caused by people buying stock on margin. Buying stock on margin is incredibly risky, and they just haven't. And most people who do buy stock on margin buy individual stocks. They take on incredible asset risk from failing to diversify. So when we say young people should borrow money to buy stock, we're talking about borrowing money to buy broad ETFs, Russell 2000 kind of things. And that's so as not to sacrifice asset diversification.
And I would say that their financial advisors tell them not to do this. And they tell them not to do this, not because the theory is wrong, but because they're afraid they're going to get fired, which is essentially, if the market goes down 20%, as it has, and you're 2-to-1 leverage, then you're going to lose 40%. Now, you're still losing 40% on a small amount of money, but it's when you're starting out. And the question is, will that be sufficiently psychologically scarring that the person would then never invest again over their lifetime? And if that's mm-hmm. true, then you shouldn't follow the strategy, because in the end, you're not going to be time diversified. You'll be time diversified at zero, which is a terrible strategy. And so you have to buy into this, have to have the conviction, the fortitude to ride out what looks like going to be more volatile in terms of percentage, but not more volatile in terms of dollars. So essentially, we're increasing your risk when you're young. That's true. But we're decreasing it when you're older. And the fact that you're starting out with a little more risk is a question of whether or not people can psychologically handle it or not. And our view is we don't want to infantilize investors and give them bad advice because we're afraid that they can't actually follow a smart strategy.
So I'm 40, right? I'm going to, let's assume I live in nine. What's that?
You don't look a day over 30.
Yeah. So let's assume I'm going to live to 95, right? I think, you know, unless I get hit by a bus or something, like I don't think that's going to, I guess it's possible, but let's assume that, right? So what would I do? Be in stocks like 100%, or would I tier down to like 90 or 80, assuming those kind of metrics, taking advantage of
Sure. Well, the details of implementation are a little bit beyond, I think, what we can do talk about here. The book will go into much more detail. It's going to depend a little bit, first of all, on what your risk tolerance is. It will depend on much
you. I don't like that. The psychology gets to me.
And how are you currently invested in the market? What proportion is in stock?
So I I listen to my own, and that's probably not a good thing when I invest in stock. That's not good. Mm-hmm. So I'm like probably, well, I have Josh
20%, 30%.
Josh handles a portion of it, and then I say, you just do your thing. So I don't do it, but the stocks that I manage, which it's 100% of whatever I manage of my own personal money, which, and I put it in a tech stock. What's that?
I want to know what proportion of your retirement savings are in stock. That would give me some indication of,
it's not much.
And so, we'd want to be not, so, and then I'd also want to know what your plans are for future savings. And some people, you know, have already saved most of what they're going to save in their life. Our approach is especially appropriate for people that have most of their savings are going to happen in the future. And, you know, so what proportion of your savings has happened in the past and how much of it will happen in the future, would you say?
What port? I do my best to save 75% of anything I make.
That's a different question.
Oh,
you might be done making money.
But well done on that. Well done on that front. But let's imagine for a moment that you want to have $1 million when you retire.
Oh, I'm thinking like, oh, I got you. Like I would want to be at like, I would say I have bigger goals, but I would say at least 8 to 12 million.
Okay, let's use 10. Okay, it's a nice round number.
Sure.
If you had $10 million today, how much of that would you invest in the market?
Ooh, that's a scary.
Up to Andrew, know. He'd say zero.
Do you think people are like just not like cursed by the stock market? Do you think like they just should not? Like they just, every time I invest, I feel like it's at the top.
Like if you're investing on a regular basis over time, that can't be true, right?
Yeah, because I can't manage my own money, right? That's the problem. Saying,
if you're constantly putting money in the market every month as you save, then you can't be always investing at the top. Unless the market is constantly going down over your whole life. I don't think that's going to happen.
Yeah.
But let's go back to the question. If you had $10 million today, how much of it would you put in the market?
I would say 25%.
Okay, $2.5 million.
Mm-hmm.
So it says to me that you'd like to have $2.5 million of exposure to the market if you mm-hmm. were not constrained. So if you have less than $2.5 million exposure today, then you should be investing to try and get closer to that.
Okay.
Because
I like the perspective on that. Yeah.
Otherwise, your exposure to the market is going to go from 100,000 to 200,000 to 500,000 to 1 million to 2.5 million. And it's going to be highly unequal over time. Whereas,
and not only unequal, but if it turns out that the last decade of your investment life is a bad market decade, you're not going to do as well as if you had spread out that exposure more evenly across the decades of your life. And so
in fact, mm-hmm. you said you were worried about investing at the top, but we're trying to help stop that problem by making sure you don't do most of your investments in your 60s and 70s, where that might be the top.
Yeah.
And that's an excellent point because so many people start making money and they're like, well, let me just throw my whole paycheck in. And then the timing's off. But they don't realize that they can continue to average in their price over time to bring your overall prices down. And then eventually everything comes back into equilibrium and you could be down 20% and then 6 months you're up 20%. It could really happen fast. And what a lot of people don't realize is you can collect dividends along the way. And do you believe, Barry and Ian, those dividends to reinvest, put into cash to choose a word of the investments? Could you shed some light on that? Because that's a hot topic a lot of people ask about.
Yeah, so if those, you can make a choice whether those dividends are going to be part of your retirement savings or not. If you you could choose to consume them or to use them for other purposes besides retirement. But if you're going to use dividends to as part of your retirement plan, they should be invested in a very similar way. If you're putting 25% in stock, that 25% of those dividends should start showing up in stock if it's 200% stock. By the way, this is, you know, this be very clear, Barry and I are not financial advisors. And when I say should, this is what the way I would think about it personally, and that I'm not qualified to give you investment advice. And so that these are at least thoughts on how I would treat the reinvestment question.
And ditto here, I am also not a certified financial advisor. And so this is not investment advice in that sense. Look, money is fungible. So if you're planning to save and invest another $5,000 and your dividends are $1,000, I don't really care if you spend the dividends and put in five or you reinvest the dividends and put in four. So at the end of the day, it's really a question of how much money you are saving altogether in terms of what you want to invest in the market.
Speaking of the market, what do you think of this current market? You think, how long is it going to be in the, you know, on this downtrend? Is it, yeah, you know, what do you guys have any opinions?
So that's what we
that
don't or? Do in life. That's what
What's
we're,
that?
We're not market timers.
Yeah.
That are, we're helping you not have to try and make that guess by doing a better job evening things out over time so that you don't have to worry. Is this the peak? Is this the bottom?
Yeah, I generally follow what's called the capital asset pricing model. And I each and every year, I expect the market to beat the return on treasuries by about 5 percentage points. But with a 20 percentage point standard deviation. It can be wildly above or below. It just on average tends to give you to beat treasuries by about 5%. And I don't know when it's going to do better than that. About a third of the time, it has a third of the years, it has negative returns. That's part of the risk of, and that's negative returns of even diversified portfolios. But over time, it's a winning game that I try to play. We do have a chapter in our book on market timing. And if the PE ratio gets too hot, our colleague Bob Schiller.
Right? You're talking about the case.
That's right. The 10-year PE ratio gets too high, then if I were going to be a market timer at all, I would be like our colleague Schiller and think about putting less in the market when the 10-year PE ratio gets substantially high.
And to state the obvious, you know, there's another problem with timing. So I thought I was brilliant because I figured out to sell most of my stocks at the beginning of the pandemic. And then I just forgot to buy anything back. And so at the end of the day, I just ended up paying taxes and didn't come out ahead because essentially it's not just enough to know when to sell. You also have to know when to buy. And so better not to think about it, not to get the not transacting means you don't pay taxes. And that means you get to invest the tax dollars. And so I'm and spend more time in your life watching your kids play soccer rather than try and figure out how to time the market.
Totally. And the same side as buying, would you suggest for people who are perhaps later in life, take the same strategy in selling rather than taking lump sum? So for example, I turned 70 and a half. My required minimum distribution for the year is the 30 grand. Through your research, do you suggest taking the 30 grand lump sum at the beginning of the year, at the end of the year, or throughout the year?
Yeah. I don't know what's the advantage of taking in a lump sum. It doesn't seem to be much, in the sense that if you don't need to take the money if you don't know what to do with it. And so you're going to just put the money in a checking account. Doesn't sound like a great idea. You have expenses that tend to come in on a monthly basis, whether they be rent or mortgage or food or insurance. And so it seems to me that you want to take the money out in connection to your expenses.
Well, and I think you were also, Josh, raising this market timing on the way out. And so that also, I think, connects with Barry's other the only thing I'd worry about is that there's it's a hassle to take it out, you know, on a daily basis. And so I would, I personally am more of a quarterly person, that I assess my portfolio once a quarter. And you could go to monthly if you're more obsessive.
And if you don't need the cash because you have other ways of living, then you take it out at the end of the year. So you get the most time in the market that you can.
Well said.
I've got a few questions from a friend of mine. His name's Eric Van Trump. They're a bit more negotiation questions. You guys are, like that topic, I believe, right? So the first one is, who has been the best negotiator against you? And why?
You know, I think already that's suggesting the word opponent and against, as opposed to with me.
Yeah.
And my view is that what I want to do is create a large pie and share it. And so
you don't see it as adversarial.
Let me push two of Barry's books. He has one negotiation book that is called Coopetition, at least partly about negotiation, which really emphasizes that this adversarial competition is really balanced by a cooperation aspect. And his most recent book, which you all should go buy, is called...
And not at the library,
Split the Pie. And so this... I don't know. I would say the toughest people are people that aren't willing to recognize that there are joint gains of trade, that and that there's something to bring. Everybody can walk away from the table.
So that's a good point you bring up, because I run into those people all the time. They don't know is joint gains, right? It's like, how do you disarm the person from, or get them to do what's good for them and me at the same time? Instead, sometimes they choose what they think is just ultimately better for them, which is to not, you know, like not invest in theory, not invest. Right.
So there's two views of the world. There's a fixed pie. There's two views. There's the fixed pie view and there's the fixed share view. If you think it's a fixed pie, then my fight with you is all about the share. But if we can agree up front on the sharing, like 50-50, now actually our goal is to make the pie as big as possible, because we're each going to get half of any gains we create. Right. So I like to start negotiation by talking about how we're going to negotiate. People often jump way too quickly into price or take an adversarial stance. And it's like, well, just time out. Let's discuss what our objectives are, how we should negotiate, and how we can do this in a way that's going to be more productive.
Mm-hmm. And I like how we could tie that in to the life cycle investing strategy, because ultimately attempting to convince someone to go 200%, if they don't have the background or if they haven't read your book, that could be a tough sell, especially with how scary things are. But through perseverance and education and using those tactics, like, what would you say to someone who's like, well, I'm scared about the markets and this seems risky?
Well, the starting thing is you can go up to 100%. That's better than 80. You know, it's 25% better. And you don't need to use any leverage to do that. So the current life cycle funds, birthday funds, are just a poorly designed, and they should just stay at 100% for the first, until the people are 45, 50. But if all they did was stay at 100% for that time, nobody would have to buy them and pay a management fee because guess what? Investing 100% in equities is pretty darn simple.
And then the next step is if you could say, how about 101% in stock? If you could, you think that the world's going to come to the end, that there's some huge difference between 100% and 101%.
Yeah, Dalmatians.
There you go. The Dalmatian strategy.
Nice.
And if you
did we just create that here, or did you guys already have that?
No, on the spot.
So on the spot. And then often those people are already investing, as Andrew was pointing out, 10 to 1, 20 to 1 in real estate in a undiversified single asset, which there's some Miami condos that haven't done so well after a certain condo collapse. And, that's less diversified than the Russell 2000. So this bizarre and also with regard to human capital, people take out loans to buy their college education and degrees. And so that's a very leveraged asset there. If they can do it with real estate, if they can do it with higher education, that's another approach to try to convince them that this can be done on a disciplined basis.
And then there are other things that we can help people stop doing that are stupid. So, for example, my grandparents, loved them. They were kind, thoughtful, bought savings bonds for our kids when they were born. Paid off when the kids were 15 or 20 and so on. But that was really a poor financial decision by comparison, because it wasn't that when our kids were 5, 6, and 7, they needed bond exposure. They needed stock exposure. And they would have done so much better if they had bought a share in Berkshire Hathaway or an S&P 500 and basically kept that hidden away for 20 years. And so for some reason, people think it's a good idea to buy kids bonds as opposed to stocks.
Barry, that's what my dad did for my kids. When you say this trigger, hit it away. So that
he bought stocks.
He bought stocks. And just a couple of years ago, I was helping Jay set up a Vanguard account.
Ian's child.
Is one of my children. And Jay was having trouble setting it up. Anna was able to set it up really fast. And after like a week of hassle, it turned out that Jay already had an account, and that my dad, Jay's grandfather, had set up an account and kept it hidden away for, and indeed, we didn't learn about it until 10 years after my dad passed away.
Yeah. And I bet that account did a lot better than a savings bond.
A lot better. It was all in stock.
Yeah. And so one other thing that you can think about, if you're a grandparent and you're trying to make a present for a grandchild, do not buy bonds. That is a terrible idea. Because
I got these, they're checks, but I can't. Is that where you can't deposit them for a certain period of time? What is that called again?
I don't know. That's illegal to post data check.
U.S. savings bond.
I think it's a bond. Yeah. Like I got bonds. Okay. Yeah.
Now don't yell at your grandparents for having done that. They had good intentions, but it was still a big mistake.
Yeah. I guess it's easier now to buy stock because of the internet, right? It's just easier to.
Well, Jay's grandparent figured out how to do this some 25 years ago.
Exactly. Yeah.
So it wasn't that hard then. It just.
But also make sure you tell somebody so that they don't have to, so that it's, they learn about it faster than a decade after you die.
All right, I've got another question from Eric. It says, when buying a product or service, what percentage of the purchase is emotional compared to financial?
I don't know. Depends what you're buying.
Yeah, I don't know if these are good questions.
If I'm buying a snow shovel, I think it's not an emotional purchase. It's very utilitarian. If I'm buying a fluffy comforter, then it's going to be more of an emotional.
All right, I'll run through his. What's that, Ian?
Next question.
Yeah, I'll run through his last one. We'll get back to it. All right, it says, at what point in your career did you find the meeting sounds too good to be true?
I first heard it when I was in a production of Guys and Dolls in high school.
Because it's basically the dice where Skye Masterson has them, and someday somebody's going to squirt, bring you a deck of cards which has not yet been opened, and tell you the. Show you 1 second. That, somebody keeps on calling.
The side is going to be suddenly squirt into your ears, and it was a someone's going to offer you a bet.
Hold on, this is a historical moment here. He's taking a call. From a landline.
I need you on our
podcast.
Back in 5 minutes, if that's okay.
There you go.
I haven't seen a landline phone.
It's not really a landline, by the way, because it's VoIP.
That's awesome. So sounds good.
I haven't seen a landline in use.
Sounds too good to be true in regards to
outside of a hotel.
Yeah, here we go. Get another one. Hello. Oh, that's a stapler. Oh, well.
Or a stapler. We're using staple.
Oh, man. Well, anyway, in terms of the life cycle investing strategy sounding too good to be true, you obviously have the research to back it up. How do we push life cycle investing from where it is to being as common as brushing your teeth?
Well, most people don't brush your teeth nearly enough. Let's just start with that.
You know, an important step is to try to get financial advisors and or robo advisors to start offering the strategy on a more automated basis. That just like Andrew says, here's some money, please. Go invest it for me. This is a complicated enough strategy, like traditional life cycle strategies. It's just too hard for busy people and unnecessarily hard for them to do it themselves when so much of this can be more automated with or without the help of individual financial advisors. So I trying to have products that make this easier for you to say to here's some money, please implement the strategy for me so that I don't have to think about it. This really should be rebalanced once a month. And even for myself, I have the ability to do this idea. I believe in it, but to do it on a monthly basis, it takes a lot for me, and I do it more on a quarterly basis, and so I would myself be a beneficiary if we could make it easier for people to implement.
So I was in Nashville.
Look, economists are fond of saying there's no such thing as a free lunch, but diversification really is. And if you go back in time, and Ian can help me on this. People were anti-diversification of mutual funds. Buying the S&P 500 was viewed as a wildly bad idea because you were getting bad stocks along with good stocks. Because in general, you would be getting the average. Because you buy everything, that's what you have to get. And I'm trying to remember, was that actually illegal to do in terms of investment advice?
It was illegal for certain for trustees to invest in stock. There were pre-qualified lists of assets that were just, which were just about only bonds and some.
But then wasn't it a problem with just buying the diversified portfolio, the S&P 500? That was viewed as being not fiduciary, right?
Yeah.
And so the idea of diversifying across a large number of stocks, the fact that that was viewed as wrong and now we consider it to be just vanilla, bread and butter, basically correct strategy, it's going to take some time to change people's view about diversification over time.
And with regard to leverage, there was a time when borrowing money to buy a house was thought to be too risky. And that it's only after World War II that we started really to have the advent of 30-year mortgages.
So just walking back to, or, you know.
So you're living the golden age of time diversification.
Yeah. I like the term. Turn. Let's go back a few pages. I heard that the other day. I met Rob Luna. He's a Fox strategist, financial advisor. And he said that, and Ian mentioned this, if it was easier to invest time-wise, he said the assets under management, basically financial advisory is going to be, he said it'll be dead in 5 years, this business model of assets under management. Do you guys, and it'll be dead because of cut rate automation, what is going to disrupt the market. Basically is what he's, I don't know if it's going to be 5 years. I guess it's anything.
Well, we thought Vanguard would basically put everybody else out of business and they haven't. And Ian's work has shown the extent to which people are paying way much more money for investing in S&P 500 funds, where they're getting the same package and just paying higher prices.
Yeah. So I think that there will continue to be a diversity of ways of investing in the market, and that that yes, I think that these automated robo advisors are going to have an increased market share, but the demise of in-person financial advisors is, I think, overstated.
Yeah, I thought so, but you know, some people are out there to make bold statements. You know, yeah.
Well, we do a lot more than just invest for people. I mean, we're kind of like a psychologist to keep people in the game. Robo advisors doesn't care if you stay in the game or not. They're just going to the algorithms. I mean, we've helped people with businesses.
Oh, but with AI, they're going to care more. They're going to be much more empathetic.
Of course. Well, maybe technology will get there. So. Yeah, all this has been enlightening. How do we come up with a life cycle fund or an exchange traded fund that can do this? I would say that's something we got to do, life cycle 2.0 per se.
Yeah, so maybe a first step is to have individual financial advisors that are well educated in the way of leveraged life cycles and can help their clientele implement it, and then to see if one of these automated intermediaries steps forward. I will say that for myself, I'm a huge fan of interactive brokers, where that's how I borrow money to invest in a leveraged stock positions. And what's great about interactive brokers is that they offer a much lower margin rate than many other offerings. And so for myself, I really want to praise them for not gouging the investors who do want to borrow money to buy stock.
And there are very few tools out there you can do in life that are going to reduce your variance by 20%. And there are very other few tools that you can do that could increase your return over your lifespan by 16%. And so without adding more risk. So, you know, people can try and chase returns or think about all the extra risk people take to try and get an extra point. Here, this is a way of doing better without additional risk. We're not, just to be clear, we're not saying instead of 1, 2, 3, do 2, 4, 6. We're not trying to double your exposure every year over your life. We're trying to go from 1, 2, 3 to 2, 2, 2 and basically even things out so that Andrew doesn't end up investing $2.5 million when he's old and he's made that, but basically says, you know, damn it, I was only investing $100,000, $150,000, $200,000 when I was in my 40s. And look, at my exposure is just so uneven over time.
Yeah.
And so now I'm just praying that, that the market is going to be great when I'm in my 60s, because that's when I've got all my exposure.
So that brings me back. So I invested a whole bunch at one time, right? That, which is a mistake because I manage my own money. This was a while ago. So should I make my 2-2-2 now, my second? Like, for me, it's, I feel like I'm throwing good money after bad is the problem, right? Personally.
Look, but you can, if I'm using in, you don't have to jump in all at once to get to the leverage. So you can go, you're trying to get to 200, you can go from 80 to 100 to 120 to 150. You can take a year to do it. That's fine. So you don't have to try and time the market.
Yeah. That's not a bad idea.
And Josh, if I can throw in
psychology, scared. Because I don't want to keep throwing good money after bad. I just, you know, especially the way the market has been trending. So, but this stock can't get much cheaper.
And Josh, if I can go back a few pages, you know, as a law professor, another way that we could make progress in bringing this idea to the world is to have more enlightened regulation. And to me, it's deeply frustrating that we're offering a way for people to reduce their risk by 20%, but there's a strong chance that some regulators would react negatively. Oh, you're exposing your clients to too much risk, and this isn't. And so, someone like Andrew, who professes to be really risk averse, this is all the more a strategy that should be appropriate, and trying to get government more open to it and maybe signaling that they're more open to it could play another role in helping to bring it to the world.
Yeah, totally. And closing things up here, you know, I totally believe in it. I read it and I was like, this makes perfect sense. Everyone pretty much in America has a mortgage. Everyone is already leveraged, and they're typically, home is their largest asset. So I would definitely love to be a part of bringing life cycle investing to more and more investors and just educating people on the subject matter.
So you can buy copies and bring them to libraries, or you can just give them to your clients.
Yeah, exactly. So we'll get more and more clients over time, and over the course of time, good strategies end up performing better, and the better the performance of the strategy, the more people will want to be a part of it. So I thank you both for being here. Yeah. Thanks for being here. I look forward to connecting and staying in contact, and enjoy the rest of your day.
All right.
All right.
Here's to your investing $2.5 million, Andrew.